to me, deploying a CSP is kind of like 50% of the value. You're getting that defensive measure. You're getting the blocking action. But if you as the host don't know that the client is constantly stepping in and taking defensive measures, you can't go fix the actual underlying problem.
Hi, you're listening to The Secure Developer. It's part of the MyDevSecOps community, a platform for developers, operators, and security people to share their views and practices on DevSecOps, Dev and Sec collaboration, cloud security, and more. Check out mydevsecops.io to join the community and find other great resources. This podcast is sponsored by Sneak. Sneak is a dev-first security company helping companies fix vulnerabilities in open source components and containers without slowing down development. To learn more, visit sneak.io. On today's episode, Guy Pajani, president and co-founder of Sneak, talks to Scott Helm. Scott is a hacker, researcher, and builder of things. He's the founder of Security Header and Report URI, as well as a Pluralsight's author, BBC Hacker in Residence, and award-winning entrepreneur.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to The Secure Developer. Thanks for tuning back in. Today, we have Scott Helm with us. It's kind of unclear to say from what, you know, works on Report URI, works on security headers, works on a variety of different things. Scott, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, no worries. Thank you for having me.
So Scott, we're going to talk front-end security and security practices today. We'll sort of dig into things that are a little bit more sort of subject matter than maybe some episodes where we dig into security organizations or structures. But before we dig into those areas, tell us a little bit about yourself. What is it that you do and how you got into security?
I guess I got into security just through interest. So my history, I did software engineering at university. I've been into computers forever, so I've always been kind of a bit of a tech geek. Did software engineering at university. Graduated in 2008 in the middle of a financial crisis, so job hunting didn't always go well when I graduated. Yeah. I went into tech support originally, so graduated through first, second, third line tech support. And then I actually moved into quality assurance. So I went to be a junior QA, originally working on more the hardware side of things. So actual physical hardware device QA, so electrical safety, environmental, things like that. Then I moved into software QA, which was a bit more of an interesting field for me. Pushed all the way through the ranks, did a few different roles there, eventually moved into automated software QA. So then I was really hooking my degree in software engineering with my interest in QA, which is kind of like the interest in breaking stuff. Testing if things work, what happens if we press this button 47 times. Kind of that inner destructive child in me, I think, was really happy. And eventually in the automated testing roles, back then security was just becoming a bigger and bigger thing. And I just started reading a few blogs online and it was like, hey, if I type in like these special characters into the field in our application, it just explodes and it's like some security issue. And I was just like, wow, this is really cool. You can do really bad stuff with just some small bits of knowledge. And I started integrating security tests into our, what was at the time, just like a functional and regression testing suite. Then I just kind of opened Pandora's box. I just found myself engrossed in reading blogs, watching videos, and it's so fascinating. And I started finding issues in things around me, like tools or products, or the biggest one that I did back in kind of like 2013, which made really big headlines and got me into the security game officially, was my home router. It's got like a web interface and you can log in and change the Wi-Fi name and stuff. And I found some really critical security issues in it, tried to tell the company, it went horribly wrong. It made like national headlines here in the UK. And then a pen testing firm approached me. And they were like, hey, you're doing this stuff in your spare time. You should come get paid for this. And I was like, wow, getting paid for my hobby. That sounds like a great idea. And for anyone listening, that's the best way to ruin a hobby is to start doing it as a job. And then, yeah, just pen testing. Pen testing was great and it was good fun and it pays well. But it was just like, why are we building products and testing the security stuff at the end? This just seems really daft because someone would spend 18 months building a product and then I would come in and just kind of like bulldoze it. And I felt awful because he's like, no, go back to the beginning. This is terrible. So that pushed me more into a consultancy role, which was really fulfilling to head off those issues at the pass. And then eventually to kind of where I am now, which is training, you know, because my role at the time was I was trying to push the security knowledge as left as we could. So like pen testing is at the end, consultancy, you can come in like the middle of a project. And training was basically trying to embed the knowledge at the start. So I do a lot of training now. I only do two courses, one on encryption with Ivan Ristich and TLS, and then one on application security with Troy Hunt, who, if people aren't familiar with those two chaps, they should totally check out. And that's pretty much where I am now, really. So that's from the start to the end of Scott.
I love the path. Different guests on the show, you know, kind of have traveled different journeys. I don't think I've had anybody sort of, you know, do it through overly publicized hack of some sort of existing systems. I like the QA analogy as well of just like understanding that, you know, you're trying to find flaws and building up from there. Definitely relates to why you find these problems at the end, you know, when you can kind of help.
Yeah, avoid them, sure,
in the first place. So Scott, we'll talk about sort of, you know, broader security practices or what you should do. But one of the areas, you know, you mentioned a couple here of application security or encryption, but really a lot of them revolve around front-end security or sort of securing your website's interface to the world and the page that is in the browser. How do you see front-end security fit into the broader picture? Do you feel people care about it less? They care about it more? What do you find when you talk to people about their TLS Cypher suites or needing to protect in the browser? Are they conscious of these risks? Has there been change over the last few years?
I think there's definitely been change in the last few years. And the two training courses that I do, I guess they just came through looking at the market and seeing where the gaps were. Like, this is how I started Security Headers and Report Your Eyes. What is the thing that we need that isn't there? And that's what got me really heavily involved in the TLS training course, because as we all know, HTTPS on websites over the last few years has become, it's not become important. It was important before. I think the correct thing to say is probably people are realizing how important it now is. And we've had huge pushes from the browser vendors in changing their UI. Search engines now prioritize encrypted pages. I think finally 2020 is the year where we can say all websites need to be HTTPS now. And we have the tooling in place to actually realistically make that statement, right? You know, all websites needed HTTPS a few years ago, but it was too difficult. There were technical barriers. There were cost barriers. It was prohibitive. And now I feel I can kind of finally say that and actually have the tools and everything around us to back that up for people to do it. And the same again with application security as well. You know, I think the relentless sequence of events playing out in the media of companies being breached and these things happening now, perhaps not the best motivator for organizations to start taking application security more seriously, but it certainly seems to have been effective. So I think we have this dual pronged approach where some organizations are maturing and realizing that they need to take application security more seriously. And then others are just kind of looking around and being like, wow, really bad things can happen. Maybe we should get on board with this. So I don't really like those negative motivators a lot of the time, but I think they are being effective in terms of encouraging people to take application security more seriously.
Yeah. And I think, you know, fundamentally, when you deal with risk reduction, there's some amount of the conversation needs to happen about what if that risk materializes, a full way of avoiding that. You talk about application security, but different people, unfortunately, that definition is not as consistent on it. What do you capture under the scope of application security?
I guess that's a fair point, actually, because my experiences more recently are largely focused around the web front end. So we mentioned Report Your Eye and Security Headers, which I guess are very indicative of where my interests lie at the moment, because I've followed through with those two projects for the last few years. So
maybe tell us a little bit about Report Your Eye and Security Headers, because I don't think everybody...
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah. So I'll start with Security Headers because that came first. So there's a heap of different HTTP response headers that have been standardized and allow an application to control security features in the client, in the browser. So we have one of the most common attacks people may have heard of is something like cross-site scripting, where you inadvertently end up with JavaScript in the page that shouldn't be there. And headers like content security policy allow you to declare a whitelist of content that should be on your page, and therefore also obviously content that shouldn't be on your page. So if the browser loads your page and there's a script tag there, the browser would just normally just execute the script tag because that's what it's supposed to do. But now with the introduction of content security policy, the browser can say, okay, so this web page is only supposed to have JavaScript from these three locations, but there's JavaScript loading from this fourth location, not on the list. The browser would block that fourth location and block that script. And this is all controlled with a HTTP response header. And CSP is probably, looking at the data, it's certainly the most commonly used security header. So it's, you know, it's kind of the easiest and the first to talk about, but there are several other response headers that control different things. Like, for example, is the page allowed to request permissions for the camera or the microphone? If we flick this over into like a privacy control now, you might say, well, we never have permissions for the camera or microphone in our application. We don't need them. So you can disable them on the page. Now, if you're loading advertisements or third-party content, that will prevent them from being a little bit naughty and devious and trying to request microphone permissions. So there's a heap of these different headers and you can control a heap of different things with them. And they're all focused on security or privacy. They're absolutely worth checking out. And security headers was just an easy way to check them out. So you can go to securityheaders.com, type in an address for a website, hit scan. It takes like 2 seconds and it gives you a quick rundown of do they have any security headers set? And then do they have them set with restrictive policies or lax policies? So there is a grading system. A lot of people look at the tool and think perhaps it's a security assessment tool, but I think it's really important to remember that first and foremost, it's an education tool to let you know these headers exist, whether you have them or not, and to give guidance on how to set them up. It's not a security assessment tool. If you scan a site and they get an F grade, it doesn't mean they're going to get hacked tomorrow. You know, it is just for spreading this knowledge and information in an easily consumable way.
That's a really good way to highlight those. You know, people get scores that evoke all sorts of emotions. You know, different people, like on one hand, they sort of get a bit of a competitive vibe. You know, you want the A, you want the A plus, and so you don't like it if you get something different, but it might actually drive you to change.
That gamification is really important. It's a very powerful motivator, you know? And I think for me, it just adds a bit of fun to it. You know, it's like, oh, we've got to go turn on these security things or do this security stuff. And it's like, oh no, we've got to go get the A. You know, that's like a much more positive experience to me.
I agree. And it's also, even especially in the context of security, where there's oftentimes a lack of visceral response. You know, you can't feel that risk that you've just reduced, but you can feel the score that you've just increased. Yep. So security headers highlights a whole bunch of security headers, I guess that's in the name, you know, that you should be using with CSP at the top. But Report URI takes that to the next level.
Setting a content security policy header is great. And as I mentioned, you know, the browser will block that script and stop it from executing. It does a heap more stuff, but that's the thing people usually focus on. But if someone comes to your website and the browser, the client is taking active measures to protect the visitor, that's something that you should really want to know about. And that's where Report URI comes in. So one of the other things that a lot of these security headers can do is when the client has to step in and take preventative measures to protect the visitor, the browser can then also call back to a reporting endpoint and say, hey, here's a rundown. I loaded this page. This bad thing happened. I blocked it. And the user is safe. And the browser can dispatch that report to a nominated endpoint. And this is what Report URI does. So you sign up for an account. Most people can just kind of like run on the free tier, and then you can nominate us as your reporting endpoint. So if the client comes to your website and it's taking these defensive measures, it's blocking hostile JavaScript or whatever it may be, it will dispatch a report to us. It's just a nicely formatted JSON payload, which we ingest, and then we produce graphs and dashboards and reports on what's happening. So I'm saying reporting is really important when I'm here running a reporting service, but this is why I founded the company. And this is why I started it, because to me, deploying a CSP is kind of like 50% of the value. You're getting that defensive measure. You're getting the blocking action. But if you as the host don't know that the client is constantly stepping in and taking defensive measures, you can't go fix the actual underlying problem. And this is where I think there's kind of like a shortfall looking at CSP. It's like, okay, yeah, the JavaScript's been blocked. Awesome. We're good. And it's like, well, no, you kind of need to know that's happening. And then go and figure out how did the JavaScript get in the page. That's step two. That's the other 50%. And you can't do that without reporting. So what you actually want to do is use the CSP as a stopgap whilst you identify how did the JavaScript get on the page and fix the underlying cause. So for me, that's kind of like the whole value proposition is the blocking is a temporary measure until you fix the underlying application issue. So I did start Report UI, gosh, it was like 6 years ago now. And I saw these features being standardized in the browser and that this could be done. And I was like, this is amazing. I want it for my application. So I hit Google. I looked around and I spent like 10 minutes on Google. And I was like, I can't find a website that does this. You know, it's like if you spend 10 minutes looking for something on Google and don't find it, it doesn't exist. So I built one there. And then I was like, well, I'm just going to build one for myself. And then eventually I launched it into a company, opened it up. On average, we're processing about 64,000 CSP reports a second at the minute, which puts us in the 13 plus billion CSP reports a month. So it kind of turned around really quickly. And it's really good when we hear people say, oh, wow, you know, we saw a sudden spike in reports today. And sometimes they're really, you know, they're not attacks, right? It was like one company recently that we work with was like, oh, we pushed a new style sheet into production and we're loading it from a different third-party location. And obviously it got blocked because that new third-party location for style sheets wasn't whitelisted. But, you know, it just goes to show that is a piece of content that apparently shouldn't have been there. And we got notified about that almost immediately. We knew there was a problem. And it's like, okay, yeah, this is just a simple case of adding a new location to the whitelist. But that could have just as easily been a bad piece of
location
style sheet or something. It is really cool to see these controls that exist where you can know exactly what's going on with your site in the browser. And it's information that I still, to this day, haven't seen that you can get any other way. This is a piece of telemetry that, and you know, just to be clear, I'm not saying we're the only reporting service that does this now, but I just mean these mechanisms themselves, like content security policy. There's no other way to get that telemetry from the browser, and it's really useful.
Typically, we don't discuss tools as much on the show, but I think the reason I find this really interesting is there's indeed this lack of awareness. You know, there's a lot of evolution. You know, there's been sort of significant new capabilities added to the browsers, not only added to the browsers, but also permeated through different browsers. So now they're actually usable, because that's a challenge oftentimes in browser land, where if too small a portion of your clients actually get affected there, then you don't necessarily reap the benefits. But then the next iteration is that people need to understand those problems. And the sort of last bit very much fits the DevOps principle, right? Sort of fits the if it moves, measure it type model. Except before, you couldn't really, like, you know, I've personally had the dubious pleasure of trying to hack together telemetry from the browser, and the early performance monitoring solutions had to hack that together until it got standardized in the browser. But these are probably the most substantial security-oriented monitoring tools almost, you know, that are available in the browser. Is that a reasonable
statement? Yeah, like a couple of things there. So like the support thing, you're absolutely right. There's probably a couple of things that we can clarify for people is, number one, the support now is fantastic. As you say, you know, it's pretty much across all of the mainstream clients and also going back quite a few years as well. But the cool thing with all of these kind of telemetry mechanisms is, yeah, support's currently hovering around like 94% of clients or whatever it is, but even if it was only, let's say, like 10% of clients, if 10% of your clients are calling home and saying, hey, there's a problem on this page, it's like, okay, cool. I know there's a problem on the page. You know, we don't necessarily need to chase that 100% perfect support number, because if you have a problem and only 10% of your clients are telling you, that's going to be sufficient for you to know that there's a problem. So this is the really good thing, is that we don't have to be too worried about that lack of 100% support. I mean, we've only talked about one or two reporting mechanisms. There are so many, it's unbelievable. And they're all native. So you mentioned there, like, hacking together different solutions. You know, there's no code to deploy for anything that we've just talked about. These are all native functionalities built into the browser. You just hit the on switch. You know, you've not got a library or, you know, some agent to deploy or something like that. It's so easy to get started. It's literally just like flick the switch.
Yeah, for sure. So like we kind of jumped a little bit ahead into security headers and specifically CSP, but indeed kind of one of the security wins in this world of the web and the front end has been HTTPS, right? Over the last few years, you know, we've seen a dramatic improvement, if you will, in indeed the percentage. You're sort of saying, you know, this year might be the year in which it becomes everyone should be on it. I guess, how do you describe that change from your perspective? What were the primary drivers in making HTTPS, which has been around for a while now, suddenly get its this sort of broad adoption?
I've kind of got two different views on this. One that I can start with is like the data-driven view. So I actually run a small crawler project over at crawler.ninja, which was the cheap domain on offer at the time. It used to be the Alexa top 1 million websites. I now use the Tranco list, but it's basically a list that's produced every day of the top 1 million ranked websites in the world based on traffic and other metrics. And my crawler fleet crawls them every day, and it analyzes a bunch of different security metrics. And one of them is HTTPS. I've been running this crawler fleet for coming up on like 5.5 years. And every 6 months, I produce a report to say, what has significantly changed in the last 6 months? Where has this gone? And looking at that list and that data that I produce, the amount of change that we've seen in HTTPS in the last probably 4 years, we've gone from roughly 25% of those top 1 million websites well up into like the 70% region. So this is like hard numbers that we can actually see. There has been a significant shift in the number of websites, and that's the websites that are actively redirecting to HTTPS. So if you type in facebook.com and hit enter, are they going to bounce you to HTTPS? And the number of sites doing that is just phenomenal now. So March was my last report. I'm just looking at the data here now. And the graph line, you know, so going back to the end of 2015, we were actually well under 20% of sites redirecting. And on the latest reports now, we are pushing up to like 62%. In literally just a matter of a few years, we've tripled, more than tripled actually, the number of websites redirecting to HTTPS. So from the hard evidence backside, and Mozilla published telemetry on this, as so do Chrome, and the HTTP archive has a graph of this, and they're all seeing the same thing. And, you know, we've had encryption on the web for 25 years ballpark now. And, you know, in those first 20 years, we really didn't see that much adoption. And, you know, if you look at the web now, and I would say this to people listening, is can you think of a website that you use day to day that runs on HTTP? I'm like really hard pushed to think of something that I actually use on a day-to-day basis. Maybe there's like one forum in the back of my mind that's run by some person in a non-official way, but I really can't think of a website that I depend upon regularly that's not HTTPS now. Yeah. And I can very easily cast my mind back just a few years and think of some that weren't. So that's a really recent and very rapid change. And I think that's largely down to two factors, which was removing the cost barrier and removing the technical barrier. There's an organization out there called Let's Encrypt. They're a certificate authority that give away free certificates. And I think they've been responsible for a really good portion of that, because traditionally you'd have to go buy a certificate, and now Let's Encrypt will give you one for free. So let's say you run a forum and you're really into dogs, and it's like, let's all post pictures of our cute dogs and share them and it'll be fantastic. Are you going to pay like $200 a year to buy a certificate to encrypt that, when maybe you don't even have that kind of money to spare for a side project? And Let's Encrypt were like, nope, well, now you don't have to pay anything. Here's your free certificate. But then that left people with the technical barrier. You know, organizations now, most cloud hosting providers will just automate HTTPS away, take the pain away. If you're running your own environments, Let's Encrypt worked on the standardization of a protocol called ACME, which is like a fully automated protocol to get and deploy certificates. So I think Let's Encrypt started in 2016. That was a very new thing back then. Now it's been around for a few years. We've seen widespread adoption of ACME in various different clients in different environments. And again, it's like that maturity of the tooling and the platforms available is why we're seeing this kind of skyrocket in adoption now.
I very much relate to the excitement about HTTPS adoption. I think it's almost like above and beyond whatever the HTTPS or sort of, you know, the specific security win is. It's this great tale to try and replicate across other aspects of security. Like, it's been around, it had this lukewarm adoption for such a long time, and suddenly sort of jumped up. So I think that introspection, right, or sort of the postmortem here, it's not dead, it's actually now alive, but understanding why this happened is so important. So we talked about cost, generally reduce friction, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Remove the effort in terms of cost and effort in terms of implementation. I think that's one kind of great property. The other bit was that there was like a fair bit of almost like a consortium of relevant players, right? So Let's Encrypt came about, but then, you know, Akamai was on board and some of the big cloud providers were on board. And so sort of CDNs and some of the big hosting providers, should be noted, like, we're making some pretty significant money from charging premium dollars from HTTPS traffic well above the certificate cost, jumped in, right? And drove this change.
Yeah. So there's, it kind of like nicely ties back into the two points of a lot of providers out there were charging for SSL traffic, air quote SSL on the old term there. We use TLS these days, but there was that aspect of it. And again, like, that's reducing the cost side. If we go back a few more years, the reason that they were charging for it was that there was that complexity. There was that cost that they were bearing. And also the performance of encrypted traffic was probably a factor for them if we go back a few more years. So, you know, there was a genuine argument that could be made that this was quite expensive, this was quite technical, and there is an extra overhead. But I think one of the other really good things that we've seen is that, especially in TLS version 1.2 that came out in 2008 and version 1.3 came out in 2018, they were both so heavily focused on improving the performance of the encryption. Those actual physical overheads were reduced so much that, again, like, you're taking away one of the air quote costs, like performance costs now, not financial, but you're taking away one of the costs associated with doing encryption. I spend 2 days on my TLS course deep diving into protocols and ciphers and all these things and getting really hands-on with the technical side of it. But I always kind of just come away with this thought that, you know, one of the biggest reasons for the adoption was that it became cool. I don't know where it came from. There was this huge industry-wide effort, you know, so I can't really attribute this to any one organization pushing it, but it just became the cool thing to do. And then the standards bodies came along, and if you want stuff like HTTP2 or Brotli compression, they were all locked onto secure versions of the protocol, so only on HTTPS. So now it's like, okay, well, not only is HTTPS's performance impact negligible, but there's all of these sweet improvements that you can get on a secure connection, like H2, which makes stuff blazing fast, like Brotli, which is better at compressing than gzip. Other features like the geolocation API a few years ago was locked and removed away from HTTP onto HTTPS. That one, there's a really sound argument, right? It's like, I'm sending my long to 6 decimal points over the network. Like, okay, that should be secure.
But at the same time, it's one that is like a pure security decision, while you could have technically implemented it in a different environment. Even HTTP2, it required TLS, but you know, there were some plays. Like, it wasn't obvious that it would be. The protocol itself can run on a non-TLS connection.
Sure, because we have H2 and H2C, which is H2 clear. So in the earlier versions of the specification, HTTP2 was going to be locked to TLS secure connections in the spec. But casting my mind back now, I think the standards body backed down on that. And now we have HTTP2 and HTTP2 clear. But all of the browsers are like, nope, we're only going to implement H2. So there is not going to be a H2 clear. So essentially, that wasn't standardized. You're absolutely correct. From a technical perspective, there's no reason to do that. So many people were so critical, especially of Chrome and Firefox when they decided to do this. But I kind of look at their position and think, well, they had a stick and they can yell at website operators and tell them to do HTTPS and hit them with the stick and say, do HTTPS. They could take a carrot and dangle it on the end of the stick and say, ooh, look at this nice thing that you could get over on the secure side of the web. So there was these online fighty scenarios that you get whenever we talk about things. And people are like, no, they shouldn't have done this. This was wrong. They're bullying us. They're forcing us to do HTTPS if we want H2. But then I look at it sometimes and think, but that was such a fantastic encouragement, right? Now there's a reward for your effort of deploying HTTPS, and that's a really good encouragement. So I think it was the right decision. There was a lot of disagreement around that, but I'm happy with the way that that played out.
I'm with you on that camp. You know, both I remember the disagreement. I was, you know, sort of CTO at Akamai at the time. But I think it's also the right move. It is a principled move that is not that dissimilar to sort of PCI or other sort of regulations. I think PCI is maybe a decent analogy because it's a commercial entity versus a government, you know, that is saying, you know, to manage risk. But it was the browsers picking up and saying, we share the responsibility. It's a shared responsibility model here. We want to encourage you to move to this other world. So, you know, we're going to make these non-essentials only work on secure connections.
How many of the new cool browser features are locked to HTTPS now? Yeah, we saw things like geolocation be flipped over because that existed in the HTTP world. But now, it's, if you want to do anything cool in the browser, you know, all of these new powerful APIs and local storage and everything, service work, you've got to start in HTTPS land. So I just think now we're kind of over that hump and we'll probably never have that argument of like H2 clear or not again, because I feel like we've pushed over the top of the hill and any new features that get introduced now are just going to automatically be available on a secure context only. So hopefully, like, we won't have to have this call again in a year and talk about that.
So we're celebrating the sort of great security win, right? And we talked about HTTPS, which probably has the most adoption. Then we've got sort of CSP as maybe the second adoption to certain level degrees, and then security headers, not at all the same order of magnitude, probably, right, at the moment. And we talked about how the industry has kind of helped. You know, it is a security win, right? Like technology and reducing the cost, reducing the effort, giving a carrot, you know, to what you're doing it and making it cool, which goes alongside them, which is really interesting, like making it the social motion. One bit that I think is still a little bit murky is ownership. So we talk about all these three areas and it generally arise in front-end security awareness, if we call it that. Who do you see in the organization engaging with security controls? Is it the application security team that's coming along and saying, you know, you need to have the security header? Is it the development teams? And also, like, the implementation is a slightly different stack, you know, suddenly like a CDN is involved potentially, or other sort of network parties versus maybe a back-end security, which might have a different set of stakeholders. How do you see, you know, when you engage with organizations on this space, who inside the org interacts with this problem?
There's probably two really defining metrics here that I see. And if we have the size of the organization on the x-axis, I work with organizations down in like the tens of people all the way up to the thousands of people. And then on the y-axis, we have, I want to say, the legacy of the orgs. They're running large financial institutions on a much more legacy, not just infrastructure, but process as well. Some organizations, if they're lucky enough, will have security teams and they'll have dedicated security people, if we air quote that, whose job it is to do security throughout the organization. I feel like this approach is really good, you know, if you're large enough to have dedicated security people and budgets. But now I think this kind of model where, you know, you have 2 or 5 or however many people are in your security team, people that are responsible for security, I just don't think that is going to survive going forwards. I think everybody within an organization now has to have at least some small part to play within security. I don't think we can have security people whose responsibility is to do security and then everybody else doesn't have to think about security. I think we're in a world now where everybody has to have minimal baseline security knowledge and security consideration. Just like everyone in an organization has to have like some HR knowledge of what it's appropriate to do and not do in the workplace. It's like the same with security. We've just got to have this basic idea of how to conduct ourselves. And the course that I do with Troy, the Hack Yourself First course, is very much aligned on this path where the purpose of the course is not to turn everybody into penetration testers. It's just to give them that insight into how systems and applications get broken in order to have that kind of knowledge in the back of their mind so that when you're building something, you know, you might just challenge something or ask a question or like, how can this go wrong? I work with some organizations where I just liaise with the security team and that's it. And they have these like five people that are responsible for securing the whole organization. I'm just like, wow, I do not envy your job because it's such a massive undertaking and security is such a broad spectrum thing now. To other organizations where, you know, with the Hack Yourself First workshop, I literally sit down with development teams. And these are just developers who have no security in their title and no formal security role within an organization. But the organization wants their developers to improve that baseline security knowledge so that the best way of doing things is to start writing secure code in the beginning. And that requires just that little bit of security knowledge. So there's this huge spectrum of organizations and the much more modern, younger, startup-y kind of organizations, I guess, have that security knowledge embedded within development teams. And then I work in a couple of financial institutions where no one has any interest in security apart from the five people in the security team. It's super weird to see that.
DevSecOps is probably the buzzword, you know, with all the complexities of buzzwords, you know, probably best embodies the motion of changing it. But I think, you know, I fully relate to the sort of challenge of the security silo versus the developer silo. But there's also sometimes a front end versus back end. Do you find that the people that deal with the content security policy or the right security headers or even TLS, are they the same people that deal with sort of an SQL injection or compromised, unpatched container, maybe even on the dev side? What has your experience been in terms of this realm of concerns?
I definitely see that separation there. So the majority of my time is probably split between consultancy and training. And they're very, very similar in many respects, really. Training is just like more focused and attentive consultancy in some ways. So the main breakaway would be the TLS. That's usually kind of like a more focused team, a more dedicated team, and they're kind of more infrastructure-y than application people. So there's definitely a slight separation there. I don't really think I've ever come across many back-end people. Like the Hack Yourself First workshop is usually largely focused around developers and front-end people. The TLS workshop, I do generally end up with more infrastructure-focused people. They're often not application or developers or anything like that at all. So still very visible now that I think about it, that those silos are present
within the teams. And I think it's one of the challenges that sort of security teams face, which is we like to simplify and sort of say security and dev. But in practice, inside security, you've got AppSec and CloudSec, different specializations. Within development, there's definitely kind of a wide variety of world. It's a great realization to hear both on the successes, but just the general interest in the front end side, which historically has probably been the one that cared the least or invested the least in security to take up more responsibility as I guess you could also say they take on more of the functionality with the single page apps and, you know, the Reacts and Views and Angulars of the world, moving more functionality from the back end to the front end as well. Thanks for taking the time. And this has been super interesting deep dive into these different aspects. If I highly simplify, you know, and recap here, we talked about sort of, I guess, three buckets maybe of sort of security threats, HTTPS, which is on the rise and on the win, and people still need to pay attention. We didn't get to dig into that of sort of, you know, different TLS versions and sure those. We talked about the content security policy and how that should be applied, but there are two levels, I guess. You can just use it to block scripts, but you can also use it to monitor your activities over time and understand how scripts got into it. And then the security headers are a broader suite, you know, than just the CSP and definitely should be used and added to your site and sort of tuned to your surrounding. And we talked about your sort of two great tools, securityheaders.com and reporturi, report-uri.com.
Yes, that's one, yeah.
That are both great and mostly free for most users, free tools, as well as have their commercial version, especially for that reporturi, as well as your sort of two great training sessions. So like a world of information and assets about that front end security. So
yeah, maybe I'll just chuck a link to crawler.ninja in there. That's free and open. People can take the data. And then my blog has explanations on all the things that we've talked about if people want to recap on that.
With all of that already great guidance you've provided, I like to ask every guest before ending the show, if you have one tip to give a team that is looking to level up their security? Something they should start doing, they should stop doing? What would that be?
I mean, for me, with my really heavy bias, it would have to be look at the easy wins with security headers. Some of them are super easy to get started with. I like the fact that they're low cost or no cost. Some of these are just a case of switch on a security control in the client. And modern browsers are loaded with these things, so check them out.
That's great and very practical advice. Scott, thanks for coming onto the show.
No problem at all. Thank you for having me.
Thanks everybody for tuning in, and I hope you join us for the next one.
Thanks for listening to The Secure Developer. That's all we have time for today. For additional episodes and full transcriptions, visit mydevsecops.io. If you'd like to be a guest on the show or get involved in the community, you can also find us on Twitter at mydevsecops. Don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes if you enjoyed today's episode. Bye for now.